Welcome to Books and Beyond with your hosts, Karen and Lisa.
Join us for half an hour of information, entertainment, reading recommendations, and beyond. Brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
This girl.
Kia ora, everyone. Welcome to Books and Beyond. Karen is not with me today. Instead, I have a special guest, Mr. Peter Dragicevic. Welcome, Peter.
Kia ora, Louisa.
So, travellers might know or recognise Peter's name. Peter writes for Lonely Planet. He has the dream job, don't you, Peter?
It's pretty good.
So, Peter, did you know Auckland Library's catalogue has 50 books and e-books which come up with your name? You're up there with the most popular fiction writers. So how many books have you written, co-authored or researched for Lonely Planet?
I think I'm up to about 100 now. That's including multiple editions of the same book. So for the New Zealand book, I think I'm up to number edition 7.
Wow.
So a book like that, which is quite a popular one, comes out every 2 years. So I think number 7 that I've worked on is about to come out. But for some of those books, it might be one of 5 writers. And sometimes I'll do an assignment and it might be repurposed into, say, 3 books. So, for instance, New Zealand, there's a North Island book, a South Island book, there's a tramping book, there's a road trips book. So one research assignment can actually end up with the same content in a few different guidebooks and then tweaked a little bit. So that number sounds really high, but they do multiply quite quickly.
Wow. So how do you choose? How is it divvied up between everyone? I mean, I noticed some books have 3 authors, some just have 1. Is there a sort of, you know, draw straws? What do you do?
Well, ultimately the editor, the commissioning editors in London, destination editors, make the decision. But we all get to pitch for what we want to work on. And say for the New Zealand books, a good example, there's usually about 4 on that book. Because it is quite a large book. We cover it in quite a lot of depth. And my thing is I always like to keep it fresh. So each time I've done that, even though I'm onto almost the 7th edition, I think it's the 7th edition, I've done a different chapter each time. So I've added a chapter that I've never done before. So this time around, it was the first time I've ever done the Wellington region chapter, for instance. But previously I've done... but even with that, I still haven't done every chapter of that book yet.
Yeah.
And so that's my goal, is by... not to give up on Lonely Planet until I've done every chapter of a book like New Zealand.
Oh, wow.
So there's a couple left to go.
So, yeah, so it keeps it fresh and keeps it interesting for you, I guess, to... Mm.
Someone really early on to me at Lonely Planet said, look, I wouldn't pitch for the same part of the same book for more than 3 editions in a row. There's time for another set of eyes to come in and just have a fresh idea of what's good and, you know, an opinion of the changes. Because you can, things kind of can become a bit background if you go there often. So that's my rule of thumb is I try to kind of shuffle around as much as I can.
Yeah, because by your name, I'm guessing you're of Croatian heritage and you've, in one of your books is, you've recently been to Croatia.
Yes, I'm actually working on the Croatia book at the moment. And yes, that's true, I'm of Croatian heritage. I do the New Zealand book and I do the Croatia book, but I do a lot of books for countries I don't have a direct association with as well. And I think there's something to be said for both sides of that.
Yeah. Is it easier or more difficult to write about a country you're so familiar with or of your heritage? Because I read somewhere that a former CEO once said LP's Lonely Planet, mantra is telling it like it is without fear or favour. So, is it harder, easier writing about a country you know so well?
I think there is an advantage to a fresh set of eyes sometimes.
Mm-hmm. That advice you got in the early days.
Yes, yeah. And I think, you know, you can do a really good job as an outsider if you're curious and you are interested in finding out about things and, you know, and you can come with that enthusiasm of a fresh set of eyes. But there's also, obviously, you need to have local knowledge combined with that. But, you know, there are little pitfalls sometimes for being very familiar with a place. I think sometimes you can just, things can just not jump out at you in the way that a foreigner might see them.
Mm-hmm.
But usually, you know, that local knowledge is really advantageous.
Well, that's why we read the books, I guess. We want to know, you know, we're fresh in a country or we're visiting a country and we don't know, you know, that I've been caught out where I think, oh, I know this place, I know what I want to do, and I arrive and I think, oh no, you know, and you have to do that quick trip to the local tourist mm. office, and you regret not picking up the guidebook and doing your research.
I don't think you could ever do a first edition guidebook of a place you didn't know well. I just think that would be a complete mistake. But you know, because our books have, a lot of them have been around for a while now, you know, maybe 30 years, some of them, you know, there is. You know, there's a really good foundation for a lot of them, so that a lot of that really kind of core, you know, deep knowledge of the country is already embedded in the books, and you're coming there and you can, with a fresh set of eyes maybe, to sort of like go, okay, what's changed? How does this relate to me? What's missing that I felt like I needed to know and I can't find? So who can I talk to find that information? But, you know, but certainly for a first edition book or something like that, you really want someone who is really immersed in that culture to write it. They don't come up very often, to be honest, the first editions in Lonely Planet World, because we're, you know, so established and we have covered most of the world. But I did actually work on the first edition of Montenegro, which I'm quite proud of. But it is interesting with the guidebooks, because you know that it is a continuous evolution with them. So I think they get better each time as you tweak them and see the problems in the previous edition and work on them and, you know, all of that.
Yeah, well, if we get time later on, I've actually got the 2002 version from the basement of the Auckland Libraries, the 2002 version of the Venice Lonely Planet book, and then the 2018 version of Venice and the Veneto. So if we get time, we'll have fun looking at the two. But actually, I wanted to ask you, how much time do you generally spend in each country that you're visiting? Obviously, if it's a first edition, a bit longer than...
Yeah, well, depending on the... Like, Montenegro is tiny, so, I mean, you know, you're talking about not much bigger than, I don't know, Waikato and Taranaki combined or something for the whole country. But, you know, most research trips for me would be somewhere around 6 to 8 weeks. And so, for instance, I've just got back from researching in Croatia. Croatia's half the size of the North Island, and there were three of us there, and we probably all have been there for a similar amount of time. So combined, we're probably looking at, you know, 4 or 5 months worth of research time, I guess.
Uh-huh. So you split up, divide the country up?
Usually it's just regional chapters. So, for instance, I had three on-the-road chapters for Croatia. I did Istria up in the north, and I did the southern and central parts of Dalmatia, which are three distinct chapters within the guidebook. And then I also put together all of the general stuff, the background, history, and that side of it as well. But in terms of the underground research, that was enough to kind of keep me busy for, I think I was there for just over 7 weeks. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So it's a reasonable amount of time to see these, you know, quite compact areas.
Yeah. And Croatia is a very popular destination at the moment, isn't it?
Oh, huge. It's just recently... I read an article saying it was the most over-touristed country in the world in terms of visitor numbers to population size.
Uh-huh.
So they're, like I say, half the size of the North Island. They have a similar population to New Zealand, but they get something like 56 million tourists a year.
Wow.
So we think we've got it. We're crowded. We're not, comparative to
how did it feel walking around Dubrovnik with that?
Lucky and unlucky enough to go a bit earlier than I normally would, so it wasn't as crowded. And it can't, but some of those places are becoming borderline unpleasant, you know. And that's true of Venice as well, which I worked on last year. The tourism in some of those places has gone a little out of control, but they're popular for a reason. They are amazing destinations, and of course everyone wants to see them at some point in their life. It's unfortunate when those places can be swamped so easily.
Yeah, so I know tourism just seems to be unstoppable at the moment, the growth in tourism. And I was in Spain, you know, where there's a bit of a backlash to the whole Airbnb and, you know, the threat to everyday life, I guess, everyday culture. So this must be good news for a travel writer, I guess, you know, the demand. But how sustainable is it, the current situation of growth?
I think that in some places it isn't very sustainable, and they do need to have some hard questions to answer. And I'm thinking particularly of places like Dubrovnik and Venice. And, you know, for instance, I saw some wonderful images of local Venetians destroying a set of turnstiles that were put up at the entrances to Venice by the train station and at St. Marco Square, because they were like, you know, this is actually a city. This is not a theme park. You know, we don't want to have to go through a turnstile to access our own city. But then again, they also don't want to be overwhelmed by, you know, half a dozen cruise ships a day with thousands of people on each that are causing massive wakes that are actually destroying the structure of their city. And that's the, you know, I think it's hard, you know, you don't want, people need tourism to survive. You know, there's no question about it. And I'm not a person that would ever advocate that, you know, places shouldn't be visited, visitors shouldn't be spoiled, unless it's a particularly fragile environment like, say, Antarctica or some of the salt plains in South America that are particularly, or even, I guess, our kauri forests that are suffering at the moment from dieback disease that could be really affected by tourism. But you know, people do have a right to make a living in their own country, and to condemn particularly a poor country to not have tourists would be a terrible thing. And I think I still believe that tourism, travel in general, is a good thing for the world because it gives you an insight if you are, if you're open and you're not just doing it as a, you know, a bucket list, let's get a whole lot of selfies experience. It gives you an insight into another culture. It can make you a more tolerant person, hopefully, or at least understand that there are differences in the world and, you know, good and bad and whatever. So I'm a big advocate for travel, but there are some, I think the boom in cruise ships, for instance, is quite problematic in a lot of places.
Mm-hmm.
Even economically, for like places like Venice, you know, a traveler on foot, staying in local accommodation, eating out, you know, their meals, is going to contribute a lot more to that economy than someone on a cruise ship who saves their evening meal to a boat, comes in on a guided tour where the money's funneling back to one company usually, and, you know, just doesn't spend anywhere near the amount of money of someone traveling independently and staying there. And that's a real challenge, and because there are vested interests.
Yeah, because especially the boats are getting bigger and bigger each year, aren't they?
Yeah, so, and the boom in cruise tourism is extraordinary. And I don't want to knock. Not everyone that goes on a cruise is, you know, I'm not knocking the concept of it. And a lot of people, especially New Zealanders that are quite intrepid, even if they're on a cruise, will go off and do their own things and support local things. There are ways to be on a cruise and not be, you know, a problem.
adding to the pressure.
Yeah, but ultimately I think those boats do cause a lot of problems, especially for small European cities that are compact and gorgeous, because they're small. Places like Tallinn in Estonia are also pretty overwhelmed by cruise tourism. And look, you know, I would never go on a cruise myself, partly because, the worst time to ever be in one of those cities is when the boats are in. And so you're always seeing it at its worst. You're always seeing it with a whole bunch of people with little flags or umbrellas, you know, with 100 people trailing behind them, being, you know, looking bored, looking hard and bothered. You know, it doesn't look like a lot of fun to me.
Yeah, so that's just me. And we've seen it in Auckland too when the cruise ships arrive too, haven't we?
But at least the buses
picking them up, taking them to Rotorua for the day, and I was like, wow, that's a long way to go for a day.
For a day, yeah.
What do you see? You know.
Yeah, I agree. But then at least a city like Auckland can absorb a cruise ship pretty easily. You know, we're a big enough city, we don't have like a dozen of them at a time. But if you had a city the size of inner city Auckland with a wall around it, and then you funnel 20,000 people through, you really suffer, you know.
Yeah, with infrastructure, that's what, how many centuries old, you know.
Yeah, and like, you know, the poor Venetians, you know, they've got fewer people living in Venice now than there were, you know, 100 years ago or 500 or 600 years ago. But, you know, to go and get a bottle of milk at the local shop, you have to contend with, even if it's like, you know, 100 metres away, you might have to pass 300 people, you know, all with some of them with suitcases, all walking slowly, stopping for selfies on the bridge, you know. It must be really frustrating for people, you know.
Yes, it must be. Actually, last time I was in Venice, we were actually taken around by... He was actually the curator of the Rugby Museum, Italian Rugby Museum. So he knew all the locals. So we were actually walked around Venice with a couple of local ladies, and we found the trick to getting into the Basilica without standing in the queues. You just buddy up with a local who would take you in the side door. So
well, look, you know, that's
because those are the things they have to do. To set up, you know, systems they have to set up to survive in their city as a local. Yeah.
That's one of my secret, my little secrets, is I grew up Catholic, and there's always a Catholic door. You know, there's always a door you can call in for a pray, you know. And I usually do a token.
I didn't know it had Catholic door.
There's no official term. That's what I call it. Yeah. You know, but there is usually in those big European cities a way you can get in as, you know, if you're just there to and then of course, you know, you can soak up the environment and it's as well. But anyway.
Yeah. So you know all those tricks. What page is that on in the book, Peter?
That's not in the book.
So anyway, I was thinking, I don't know, best scary travel story or best funny travel story. Have you got one for us today?
You know, often the funny ones are the scary ones in retrospect. But at the time, aren't very pleasant. Like I was
the
bitten,
ones implanted.
I was bitten by a dog in Vietnam, and it was in a small town, barely a town on the coast. And I had to jump on the back of a motorbike, blood pouring down my leg, and got to the local medical center and had my Lonely Planet Vietnam phrase book, and was looking for the word for rabies. Because that was the one lot of shots I hadn't got before I went, because you rabies shots, you'd need to get six of them over a course of, you know, months, and I just didn't have the time. And anyway, of course, there was no word for rabies in the guidebook, but if I had missed my period, or if I, you know, needed emergency contraception, or there was a lot, or if I needed to fend off unwanted advances in the bar, there were plenty of words for those.
Oh.
So now it is listed in the Lonely Planet Facebook.
Experiences. Okay, so what did happen then? How did you get...
Oh, look, it was actually a really interesting insight. I also think for my job, bad experiences are often good experiences for the book.
Yeah.
So I got to see how it was to go to a local centre where no one spoke any English, and to see actually it was very professional. The healthcare standards seemed very good. And, you know, and so that just gives you a little bit of an extra insight. You know, whether you're being... Vietnam's a good example for a place where there are quite often little scams, you know, and you can see them playing out in front of you. And I just think, oh, every time if I do get scammed or, you know, something goes a little wrong, I think, oh, well, that's good to note for the next edition, you know. And it is quite often funny when you sort of see them playing out in slow motion in front of you, and I think, and you just see, I often let them go and just see how far they go before I kind of,
Which is the scam of the moment, or the scam of that, you know, you just can't sort of, you know it's happening, but you can't get away from, you know, there are those. Anything?
Look, I can't think of any particularly at the moment per se, and I haven't written about Vietnam for a long time, but back then it was, a lot of it was taxis, people with, you know, if you take your eyes off the meter, then they just start spinning around really quickly. You know, and as New Zealanders, we're so polite. We're not likely to challenge something unless we're absolutely sure, and to accuse someone of trying to rip us off is really not in our nature usually. And but you know, after you've been in Vietnam and you know for a couple of months, as I would do when I was researching a guidebook, you do get to a point where you just go, I'm not paying that. I can see that meter's been doing that for the last 10 minutes, but I'm not going to be paying that. I'm just letting you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you did used to live in Australia, I believe, so you sort of the Australian comes out in you, does it? And you're mate.
Yeah, I lived in Australia for 8 years. I lived in London for a bit, but, you know, I think being on the road too, you do, it opens your eyes to how to deal with some of those things that maybe we find a bit more confrontational.
Mm, we don't like confrontation.
No. I mean, I still wouldn't shove in front of a queue in the way that some cultures do and all of that, you know, when I'm traveling, but you do kind of learn to be a little tougher with some of that stuff, I think.
Yeah, but wiser, and that's what the joy of travel, you know, the wisdom learned and as well as the experiences. So I didn't ask you, did I? How did you get into the travel writing business, the dream job?
There's lots of answers to that, but I guess the short answer is I worked in newspapers and magazines for a long time, and I had done a bit of travel writing in the course of that, although I wasn't per se a travel writer, but I had some really good feedback on some articles I'd done. I was keen to move to London, and I didn't have a job to go to, and I approached Lonely Planet at that point. Didn't hear anything back for months, ended up doing temping and all sorts of things, and then eventually, after a very long process, there was a lot of hoop jumping to get through, I was taken on as a writer. I was lucky at that point. They were actually trying to bring in new people. Everyone always asks, how do I get into it? And I usually say, look, it's really not that easy. But I did have a look on our website last night. So I thought you might ask me about that. And there is a link to, you know.
Well, it's because we're all budding travel writers, aren't we? It's the dream job. So
yeah,
sorry. Yes.
It is. But, you know, it is a particularly weird skill set you need, in that you've got to know a little bit about a lot of things. And you've got to be really good on detail, but also be quite creative at the same time. And, you know, I know a lot of writers that are really good writers that would struggle to get every digit in the phone number right, for instance.
And you have to be so careful. I mean, every word counts, doesn't it?
The brevity is really important to it as well. And that's something I've really learned in my – that's something that Lonely Planet's really done for my writing, is make me better at being brief and describing things, you know, more succinctly, which, you know, you don't, you know, if you're writing a feature or something in a newspaper or something, you do have word limits, but, you know, there's usually, you're not looking at a 50-word review, you know. So that's been an interesting process for me as a writer. There is a link on our website to say, you know, where you can actually approach them, but I don't think they're really, it's very easy to get in. I think there was some kind of like terminology suggesting that look, this is not likely to happen. You know, they're saying like we get like over 500 approaches a year, and we've got a pool of 200 writers we work with, and you know. But from time to time, if you've got particular skills, maybe language skills or knowledge of a place that, say you're an expert on Kazakhstan or something, you know, there might be an opening for you.
Yeah.
I was just lucky. I think it was just the confluence of luck and timing.
Yeah, because the Lonely Planet story is really, really quite cool, isn't it? In the back of each book is the our story, how Lonely Planet started with Tony and Maureen Wheeler back in 1972, just writing about their overland experience through Asia and Europe. How they started, you know, on the hippie trail, perhaps, in the 70s, is really quite cool. And how they used to recruit, obviously travel writing was, you know, not the thing back then, and how they used to just have to find fellow travellers to sort of, you know, agree to write for them. So,
yeah,
you know, yeah. If you were a budding travel writer in the 70s, you were a shoo-in, weren't you, really?
I think if you had that attitude that, you know, that you were intrepid, and have an impression, some people from the past, of Lonely Planet being a backpackers or a hippie guide, but those days it shifted considerably. And I think the way I've heard, I actually was lucky enough to come in on the tail end of the Wheeler era at Lonely Planet when Tony and Maureen were still running it. They sold maybe 7 years ago or something, they were still very actively involved when I started. And their thing was always about an independent attitude. You know, wanting to do it yourself, wanting to, you know, not wanting to be told what to do, not to want to go on formal tours or cruises or whatever, just to be able to go there and just do it, you know. And so I think that's the sort of people they would have looked for at the beginning, people that just, you know, had that intrepid attitude to go and do it. But that doesn't necessarily mean budget, you know, because a lot of the people that grew up with Lonely Planet in the early 70s and into the 80s maybe are now a little older and have a little more money to spend when they go travelling. And, you know, they've still got the attitude of wanting to go and have an authentic experience, but that maybe they might want to also try the best restaurant in town. You know?
Yeah, yeah. So it's still for the independent traveller.
That's our ethos, really, is independent traveller and trying to get under the skin of a location, you know.
And just, you know, going off into the horizon and doing your own thing. It's very cool concept, and living the dream, I guess, isn't it? I'm still trying to think of what my next destination might be. What is hot at the moment, by the way, as far as destinations go?
Oh, look, you know, I guess the ones that you'll see in the media a lot at the moment are places like Iceland, Croatia,
Vietnam.
And I've been lucky enough to write about a lot of these places, actually. New Zealand, I guess.
These things are
amazing for many reasons. And, you know, something like Croatia is interesting because, you know, there's a thing in travel writing and newspapers particularly where people want to find the next hot destination, you know, and it's almost like it is a cliche and it is always a bit contrived. But, you know, there was a period when, especially when Europe was opening up after the Cold War, where it was like, oh, everyone should now go to such and such a place, and we've discovered it, that sort of attitude.
Mm-hmm.
And so for a while it was, you know, the Croatia is the new Greek islands, or the new Mallorca, or the new, and then the next one comes along, and then it's, you know, Montenegro is the new Croatia, and then it's Albania is the new Montenegro, and it's like, it is, you know, we sometimes forget that these are kind of conceits of it's particularly from you know, an English-speaking media point of view. You know, French people and German people have always known Croatia was hot. You know, an awful lot of New Zealanders would have gone to Yugoslavia when it was hot in the 70s, you know, and 80s, more the 80s, I guess, when it was really booming. So these things come and go a little.
Mm-hmm.
But great destinations are great for a reason, you know, because they're beautiful naturally, because they've got amazing history, because they've got amazing nightlife or whatever, and that doesn't change that much, I don't think.
Yeah.
Places open up and close, I guess, though. Like, say, for instance, you were talking about Tony and Maureen, the hippie trail. That was, you know, the people that had that experience of going through places like Afghanistan and Iraq and Iran, and they were amazing places to travel, and I'm sure they would still be if they were more safe and secure. But, you know, those experiences that they had really formed their impression of tourism. And, you know, it is a shame that some places, you know, become more and more difficult or less difficult to access as a...
Yes, it's often after peace has arrived, you know, after conflict or something, that a place is now accessible and suddenly we all want to visit it.
Hopefully
I was thinking of Sri Lanka.
Yeah,
you know,
that's a
if
good
you
example.
Can't afford the Seychelles or Mount Ives for your honeymoon, I've noticed a lot of people are opting for Sri Lanka and it looks fantastic. And their Instagram shots, you know.
He's hoping that sometime I'm writing an article saying Afghanistan is the new Croatia. You know,
yeah.
Or something like that, because, you know, hopefully that these places will be able to once again celebrate the beauty and the history of their own cultures and have people experience it.
Yeah, well, your expertise is in history, so we look forward to that. Now, we've run out of time. We didn't do our treasures from the basement. We didn't get to have fun with our Venice book. And we didn't even get to, maybe we'll fit it in, before we go to your song that you've picked for us today. Since May, Auckland Libraries has had a special list of the latest Lonely Planet e-books, which are available anytime, anywhere. And Peter, you'll be pleased to know three of your books feature in the top five of this list, the most loaned books on this list. So there's the Lonely Planet's Best New Zealand, the London Travel Guide, and number two on the list is the Italy Travel Guide. But I'm sorry, you're not in the number one spot. Any idea what book is in the number one spot?
I have no idea.
I don't know if this will be a surprise to you. It's Rarotonga, Samoa and Tonga Travel Guide. So how cool is that?
See, I have worked on that in the past. So hopefully some of my words have survived into that in Samoa and American Samoa sections of that book. But that's great. I mean, I can see that... for those sort of, especially the, you know what, one thing we haven't meant to say as well, if we have time, books are a great technology when you're traveling. A physical book is a great thing to take with you. It doesn't run out of batteries. No one's going to necessarily steal it. You know, you can read it at the bus stop. You can catch up on your history. You can, you know, all of that. You can use it practically with the maps and not have to spend a fortune on data. E-books, you know, have their place. But, you know, I think in terms of actually on the road, they're not as easy, but they're great for planning.
Yeah. do remember my shoestring book when I did my OA as a young girl. It was so large that I used to rip out the sections after I left each country. I feel embarrassed saying that and doing that to a book. It's terrible. But yeah, you're so right. You can't, they're great to take on. They're like your companion. If you're traveling alone, you have your guidebook and you're not alone, you know. So we've run out of time. So thank you so much for coming in on, you know, cold winter evening to talk about your travel and writing experiences with it. With us today. Remember, I'm always available as a researcher if you need one on your travels. And ka kite anō.
This program was brought to you by Auckland Libraries. Find us online at aucklandlibraries.govt.nz and catch the program next Sunday at 9:35 p.m. on 104.6 FM or anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/booksandbeyond.